So tonight I'll be talking about the joy of Dhamma practice. This is a topic I was given. And on the one hand, it's a bit of a difficult topic to take. It's kind of like asking a doctor to talk about good health, because they're so much used to talking about sickness. So on the one hand, it's always much more fun to talk about suffering, as Buddhist teachers. Because the Buddhist teaching is meant to challenge you. It's meant to challenge us to open up and to change things about ourselves. To let go and to let be and to broaden our scope of acceptance, so that we're able to accept the things that would normally be rejected, that we'd normally push away, and to let go of those things that we cling to. But I'm not complaining. Just to set the tone here and to sort of, because talking about joy of Dhamma practice or joy in regards to the practice of the Buddhist teaching, we have to understand joy in terms of in a Buddhist context. So I'm going to talk for a while, but I would like to give time to open the floor for questions. And I see there are at least a few people here who were at our courses on Sunday and Monday, so I'd also like to broaden the question period to take in questions about your meditation practice, because this is our last chance to talk about the meditation practice. Tomorrow I'll be heading on to Toronto. And so I'm going to give some time at the end for questions as well. The two dangers that I can see in talking about joy in regards to the Buddhist teaching are, first, that you might mislead people into thinking that it's okay to cling to something, because joy is one of those things that it's very easy to cling to. And the Buddha said, "Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya." All dhammas are not worth clinging to. Even the good dhamma. Even good things. Because there's nothing wrong with joy, but clinging to it the Buddha said it's like clinging to a raft. When you want to cross a river, you have to build a raft as a means to cross the river. But when you get to the other side, it's appropriate that you throw the raft away. Something that's useful. Something that's beneficial. Because it served its purpose. And he said that some people are like a person who, after they cross the river, they think, "Wow, what a great raft," and so they pick it up and put it on their back and carry it with them wherever they go. The Buddha asked, "Is this an appropriate way to behave?" And he said, "No, it's better if you throw the raft away and go on your way and forget about it." So again and again in the suttas you'll see the Buddha praising the practice that leads to joy, praising the practice that leads to happiness in the here and now, and boasting that his teaching does lead to that. But then turning around and telling you that you shouldn't cling to it. Whatever joy you gain from the practice, it's also not worth clinging to. It's not the end of the road. So that's the one extreme, the one extreme that we have to avoid, the misunderstanding that perhaps this is the goal, or seeking it out. So then when I leave you and you go to practice meditation, you start looking for joy. And when joy comes, then you cling to it and think, now you've made it. and think that, and you become negligent, or you become heedless, complacent. The other extreme that we have to be careful about is if we're to disdain the joy that comes from meditation practice. Because the joy that comes from the Buddha's teaching, as I'm going to try to explain, is something that's very difficult to obtain. And the further you go in the practice, the greater the joy, or the more refined and exalted the joy becomes, the happiness becomes, the harder it is to obtain. And so it's easy to fall into the idea that it's good to suffer, that somehow the meditation practice has to be painful. You get used to the difficulty of the practice. And it can happen that we miss the joy and the happiness, which is, happiness is really the true goal of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha is called the happy one. He said of himself that he was happy amongst people who were unhappy. That one of the characteristics of his teaching is that he was able to dwell happiness among people who were unhappy. So this is to sort of set the context, because we're going to try to avoid both of these extremes and put joy in its place in regards to the Dhamma practice. And I'll try to talk about the ways in which we can bring about joy and some of the joy that comes from the various aspects of the Buddha's teaching. I'd like to encourage everyone that while you listen to the talk, that you actually try to put into practice the teaching that you're familiar with. So everyone here, I would say, has probably some experience with meditation practice. So try to take this as a meditation. In the Buddha's time, many people became enlightened while they were listening to the Dhamma, because they put into practice the Buddha's teaching as they were listening to it. If you don't believe it, then you can try for yourself and see. Because probably you can notice that by now there's many dhammas that are arising. There will be kusala dhamma, dhammas that are wholesome, some wholesome thoughts that you feel happy that you're here. There may be unwholesome thoughts, and maybe you feel upset or bored, or maybe judgmental or so on. And then there will be the abhyagata dhamma, the dhammas that are neither wholesome nor unwholesome. These are the aches and the pains that we have, and the itching and the hot, the heat and the cold, and the softness and the hardness and so on. The sounds that we hear, the sights that we see. So most of reality is neither wholesome nor unwholesome, neither good nor bad. It just is. When you see things, it's just seeing. When you hear, it's just hearing. But because we're not mindful, we give rise to liking and disliking and judging and attachment and identifying with the objects of the experience. And so as a result, we're constantly beset by suffering and displeasure. Yeah, I can't help it, I have to get into the negative side. This is what we're trying to avoid. So it behooves us to take the moment that we have. The Buddha said, don't let the moment pass you by. And he really meant, I think, the moment, the present moment. Because you can think of the moment in terms of us being born as humans, or having a chance to listen to the Buddha's teaching and so on. But the Buddha's teaching is really meant to be understood in the here and now, which is only one moment. So here we have that moment, we can take the time to practice. Well, I'm explaining the Buddha's practice. the Buddha's teaching. So we're talking about joy and practice. These are two terms, and it's important to explain them. And I think by explaining them, it'll be clear what is joy in Dhamma practice. First of all, I think it's important to talk about the joy you get from not practicing, or the joy in not practicing the Buddhist teaching, because then we can contrast the two. For someone who doesn't practice the Buddhist teaching, or let's say someone whose practice is contrary to the things that the Buddha said we should practice, whether they know the Buddhist teaching or not, those things which we call unwholesome. Because it's recognized even by the Buddha that there is joy in evil deeds, in unwholesome, unskillful qualities of mind, to some extent. And this is the joy that we're not looking for. This is the lowest kind of joy. But the funny thing is, it's also, in general, the easiest. So what we're going to find is that as we practice, and as I said, as we get higher up, it's going to become more difficult. It's very easy for us to find the animal pleasures in life. It's easy for us to find pleasant sights and sounds and smells and tastes and become attached to them. And this is not according to the Buddhist teaching. This is the joy that the Buddha called kama sukhali kama yoga. It's an extreme. It's something that does not lead to any benefit, because the joy is tainted by a clinging. The more you get of it, the more attached to it you become. And the funny thing about attachment is the more attachment you have, the more pleasure you need to satisfy the attachment. I think that should be easily understandable, even if you haven't practiced to see this. And this is confirmed by science. If you know anything about biology, if you've done any studying on secular addiction studies, science is able to pinpoint how in the brain this process works. That there arises a pleasant stimulus, and as a result, these chemicals are released, and the system, the pleasure, the gratification system starts to work. But the more it has to work, the more taxed it becomes, and it begins to lose its potency. And so more of the chemicals required the second time and the third time and so on. And this is how addiction gets out of control. That the first time you have something pleasant, it's a very little bit of it will make you happy. But the second time and the third time, and the more you partake of it, the more taxed the systems in the brain become, the chemicals. The reactor system, whatever it goes. Which I think is exactly in line with what we understand in the Buddhist teaching, in Buddhism. Is that, as I said, the more clinging you have, the more of the stimulus is required. So for this reason, the Buddha called these ignoble. He said, anaryo, this kind of pleasure. And I think this is very difficult for us to agree with and to accept, because in general we are surrounded by these things, especially in the West. It's funny coming here how much difference you see in compared to a relatively traditional society, a society that isn't technologically advanced so much. But here it's quite difficult to get away from these things, and it becomes very much a part of our life. Now, the good thing is that the Buddha didn't condemn people who partake of these pleasures. He just said this isn't his teaching. And he pointed out there's a danger. There's the gratification, that sensual pleasure of any sort, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling pleasure, pleasurable sensations, pleasurable stimulus, has a gratification and has a danger to it, because it's impermanent. It's not something that lasts, and because of the craving requires it to be always present, it requires it to be always available. And when it's not available, then there arises discomfort and displeasure. So that's the joy, the joy of not practicing. The joys that you can find are the joys that most of us are familiar with. And many people, this is a reason why many people come to the Dhamma, come to the Buddhist teaching, because they've partaken of these pleasures and found them to be unsatisfactory. They've realized this truth of clinging, that eventually it catches up with you. We went to a funeral recently in the Sri Lankan community, and I was asking the monks if it's the case that, because I don't get to go to funerals that often, where the families will always cry, and so they said, oh, sometimes it's terrible. And so that really got me thinking about this, because I didn't realize that it's such a moving thing. You know, I guess you hear about this, but to actually see people crying was something striking for me. And then to think about it in terms of the Buddha's teaching, that because we don't realize it, and the people who are crying are shocked by it as well. They prepare a speech, and they expect to be able to say the speech, but then suddenly the emotion comes up. And so I think this is really how it is with us. As the Buddha said, you don't realize the problem until the cup is full. If you keep pouring water into a cup, drop by drop, it seems like there's no problem with continuing to pour more water in. But once it gets full, suddenly it spills over. And he said, in the same way, when we do something unwholesome or unskillful, when we get involved with craving and clinging, the Buddha said it's sweet. It has a sweetness to it until the deed is ripe, until the time comes to pay the price. And again, this isn't to condemn people who attach to their relatives, but it's for all of us to realize that actually this is what our attachments, this is the price, or this is the danger, as the Buddha said, with them. So there's no... there's no reason to condemn these sorts of things, but it's important for us to be aware that this is really the lowest type of joy, that there are higher joys in life than clinging to the senses. And so the other joys are the ones that you think in terms of the Buddha's teaching or in terms of practice of the Dhamma. So what do we mean when we talk about practice of the Dhamma? Well, I assume that what was meant was practice of bhavana, of meditation practice, but I'm assuming also that we are all aware that the Buddha's teaching is actually, to some extent, broader than the practice of just meditation, and that we all accept the fact that our practice is much more holistic or encompassing than that. And so it is important to recognize the other joys that come from the Buddha's teaching. Not simply, and actually I was surprised, I was told that I could also talk about the joys of textual study. So we understand that there are other parts to our, or other aspects to our Dhamma practice. But the Dhamma practice is also not just study and meditation. Dhamma practice is a living of your life in a way that cultivates goodness, that cultivates wholesomeness, and that is conducive towards insight and wisdom. So there are many things that are conducive in this way. The first one that we learn about in traditional Buddhist societies is dana. And it's a bit of a shame that this is as far as many Buddhists ever get, but it's very much worth noting that by giving dana, a charity, sorry, the word dana means charity or generosity or gifts. Let's say charity. No? By giving charity, there's a great joy that comes from it. And this is, I think this isn't understood well enough in the Western world. And I had the privilege to hear from a Western person who wasn't Buddhist and had no knowledge of Buddhism at all. What I think is the right, or a very good view of giving. She said, "I don't give for other people, I give because I'm selfish." And I didn't understand. At the time, I also had no clue about Buddhism, and I wasn't a very generous person myself, so I didn't understand what she was saying. And she said, "When I give to people, it makes me happy, that's why I give." And I think it's rare to find people who can see that clearly if they haven't had the benefit of the Buddhist teaching. But I think that's really at the core of generosity, or at least it's a very important part. I don't think it's wrong to give for the benefit of others, and the Buddha never said it was. In fact, in terms of our Dharma practice, we consider that when we act, we're doing it simply what's appropriate. We're not acting for our benefit or for the benefit of another. We're acting because that's the appropriate thing to do. And an enlightened being, an arahant, they simply do what's appropriate at every moment. They don't think this is going to benefit me or this is going to benefit someone else. They do it because it's the right thing to do. But the point here, and in terms of the talk that I've been asked to give, is that we should never forget about the importance of giving charity. This is a joy that the Buddha recommended, that the Buddha endorsed, and it's also a joy that's more difficult to obtain than the joy of sensual pleasure, for most people. Because it requires us to go against what we've been taught to be in our best interest. Most of society teaches us that to get is the best thing, right? And we have both of these inside of us, the desire to give and the desire to get. We have to overcome the desire to get and the desire to possess in order to be able to give. And so it requires the development of the mind. And this is probably the best explanation of why the Buddha endorsed charity. Not because it simply makes you feel good, but because the reason you feel good is because you're lighter. You're less attached and less clingy. The freedom of mind that you have from this heavy mind state of clinging. If you've ever felt this, when the time comes to give, the opportunity comes to give something, it can often be great suffering, because suddenly you can feel your own clinging. You can feel your attachment coming up, and this is the fight that goes on. In the Buddha's time, there was a man who, between him and his wife, they had one robe. Because in India at that time, everyone wore robes. And they heard that the Buddha was coming to give a talk, and so they had to choose who was going to go out to listen to the Buddha's teaching. They couldn't both go because they only had one robe between them. They were that poor, probably living in a grass hut or something on the side of the road. And so the husband somehow got the opportunity, and came to listen to the Buddha's teaching. And the Buddha saw him there, and he knew that this guy was, he had a chance to do something very special. And the Buddha also wanted to help this man, so he gave a talk specifically on giving and the benefits of giving. And right away the man wanted to give up his robe. He had nothing, but he had this robe, and this was his only possession in life. And so he wanted to give it up, but he thought, oh, I can't do that. My wife is... What will my wife say? What will people say? I'll be naked. And then on and on the Buddha talked, and the second time, and then the third time, until finally he just walked up to the Buddha, took the robe off, placed it at the Buddha's feet, and yelled out, I win. Or I'm victorious, or I have conquered. I believe the correct translation would be, I have conquered. And the story goes, it happens that the king was sitting there listening to the Buddha's teaching. And kings don't like to hear other people say, I've conquered, I've conquered. So right away the king was woken up, and he came out of his meditation and listened and heard this, and asked someone to find out who this man was. And when he found out, the story goes that this man was given great honor and riches and so on. But this is really the fight that we all fight when the opportunity comes to give. And I just want to point out that this is what makes the Buddha's teaching a challenge to us. Even here at the basic level of just being charitable. Of course, it's not only the Buddha who taught charity. You don't have to be Buddhist to practice charity, but it's in terms of the Dhamma, we can see that there's a conflict here. We have to win out over our craving, over our attachment. And so this is a beneficial practice, something that we consider the practice. So you're not just doing it for the joy, but you're doing it because it's a practice that makes you a better person. The second type of joy that we find in the practice, or the second type of practice that leads to joy, is the practice of morality. So we still haven't gotten to the meditation practice per se, but in dana, giving charity is a way of developing yourself, and the second one, sila, is also a way of developing yourself. We should consider these to be a part of our meditation. As I said, with dana we consider it to be part of practice, and with sila, it's not just rules that we keep. It's not just the house rules, so to speak. We're not just keeping these rules because they tell us to, and because if we don't, they'll kick us out, or they'll look at us funny, or they'll look down at us. Sila, or morality, is a very much a part of the Buddha's teaching, and it has to be a part of our practice. The sila, the basic definition of morality is physical and verbal acts. The abstention from physical and verbal acts that are based on unwholesomeness. So whether or not the unwholesome states arise in our mind, morality is when we can stop ourselves, when we stop ourselves from acting and speaking in ways based on that unwholesomeness. So sila is considered to be the very beginning of our training. When we undertake the training, the first training is in morality, because it's the most external, the abstention from external unwholesomeness. Eventually we're going to try to get into our hearts and uproot even the latent defilement. But the first type of defilement that we want to get rid of is our physical and our verbal. So this is what it means by morality. It's not a number of rules even. We have the five precepts as Buddhists that we try to keep, and we can have many more rules if we decide to ordain. But ultimately it's more of a category of defilements. You can even walk with anger, you know, if you're stomping around the house. This is immoral in this technical sense. It's not immoral in terms of how we normally think of the word, but it's just, for lack of a better word, we say it's immoral because it's something that's based on anger. If you talk with anger, maybe you say something but you're angry, then this is immoral in this sense. Now, again, morality, I think, is probably even more difficult to find joy in than charity. I think it's easy to see the joy that comes from charity, though it can be suffering in the very beginning. Once you begin to practice generosity, it becomes a great joy and something that you're able to reflect upon, because you get more skillful at it. Well, morality is the same. And the Buddha even said that there are many monks who become monks and really have a hard time with it and suffer a lot. And I even know there are teachers who say that don't try to keep the rules strictly. Don't try to keep all of the monks' rules. Don't be too strict about the rules. And this is because they see that the monks who do that suffer. Monks who try to keep all these rules will tend to have to suffer a lot, because it's going against their desires and their wishes. Any of the little rules, not even being able to have soya milk in the evening or so on, not being able to keep sugar, not being able to this or that, many little things that it's very difficult to find happiness in. But I think even the five precepts can be difficult for us to find happiness in the beginning. When you first have to, if you're a person who socializes and who engages in Western society, Western social culture, social norms, then when we first start to abstain from taking drugs and alcohol mostly, it can be quite a bit of suffering on many levels. It can be suffering in our minds. When the inhibitions, when we are stopped from being happy and so on, when we feel self-conscious, right away we want to take alcohol and be free from the inhibition. We find we're much more, as they say, you always think you're more fun when you're drunk. It's not necessarily true, but you always think you're more witty, you always think you're more clever when you're drunk. It's always more fun. And so to stop this can be difficult. But I don't think that's really the hardest thing, the greatest point. That the real problem with stopping things like drugs and alcohol or many of the precepts is that it causes conflict with the world around us. We have to disrupt the ordinary state of affairs, because the ordinary state of affairs, not just in the West, but throughout the world, even in the Buddhist world, unfortunately, is the breaking of the precepts, the indulgence in things that are leading to negligence and unwholesome, unskillful states that lead people to become drunk and intoxicated on many levels. So your friends will not be happy to know that you're not drinking anymore. And you might not get invited to many parties. Or you won't be much fun at the parties, or you won't fit in at the parties. Now, there are ways around this, but I'm mentioning this because I think it's an excuse many people use, many Buddhists use. They say that they drink socially, which is unfortunate, because they could do such a service to the world if they were to keep the precepts as the Buddha enjoined us to keep them. It would be a reminder for people that you don't have to drink to be happy, you don't have to be drunk to be intoxicated. You don't have to take the edge off with chemical means. And you can go through all the precepts, and I think they all have an aspect of this. So killing, you know, when you go out in the wilderness and you want to kill mosquitoes, even lighting the, I'm told that lighting this mosquito coil is killing the mosquitoes. If you look on Wikipedia, there's an entry that it causes nerve, it destroys their nerve, or it attacks their nervous system and kills the mosquitoes. So I was told not to use these mosquito coils as an example. But when you don't use the mosquito coils, it's a great amount of suffering. I have a story in this regard though, and I have no doubt about this one because I have a story to back me up. When I first started meditating in Thailand about 12 years ago, my first teacher, he asked me to practice outside. He said, "Today I want you to practice outside. Pick a different place every time you practice." And later he told me that he meant somewhere up where it was dry and so on, but I just went outside my hut and by the rice fields did meditation, and of course there were lots and lots of mosquitoes from the rice field. And so I was sitting there and suddenly a mosquito landed on me doing my sitting meditation. And you know, this was my first time ever practicing, and I had only just heard about the precepts, and so the immediate reaction is you want to hit the mosquito, you want to kill it. But I think I was good, and I certainly didn't swipe at it. And I felt this great tension and suffering building up inside, and then another mosquito landed on me, and it just got worse, this, because it's so terrible, right? Grow up in Northern Ontario, grow up in Canada, and you become so reactionary towards mosquitoes. You have this reflex action, killing right away. And then three mosquitoes, and then four mosquitoes, and I think it ended at about five mosquitoes landing on me. And just at the time, I didn't have any clue about malaria, so which is probably a good thing because I might have freaked out otherwise. And then suddenly something broke, and the whole system of my being or whatever just gave in. And this wasn't a great realization, but it's an example of how the breakthrough comes, where you can finally find joy in the practice. Because at first it was, of course, great suffering, but as I sat there, suddenly the tension, and then I just let go because it was too much to hold on to the suffering. And this is the key, is that the suffering isn't in the mosquitoes landing on your body and taking your blood. The pain is all in the mind that can't accept it. When we sit in meditation, the pain in our bodies and the stiffness and so on isn't the cause of our suffering. It's nothing compared to the pain and suffering that exists in our minds, the inability to accept the experience that gives us such terrible suffering. And so after this, there was great rapture that arose, and you know, it was one of those first aha moments, the realization that, oh, this is the way to go. And after that, it was just wonderful to sit there, and great joy came. I want to stress this because I think we miss sometimes the joy that comes from abstention, the joy that comes from abstaining from things that we'd otherwise be used to doing. If you really are able to take it to the extent, because these rules force us to let go, and it's not the keeping the rules that that brings joy, it's the letting go. And this is going to be true with all of you, as I explained in various parts of Buddhist teaching. It's all simply because we let go. So this is another kind of joy that comes with the keeping of the precept. Something that's difficult to obtain, but one that we should be on the lookout for, and we should be careful that we don't live our lives keeping the precepts in misery, that knowing that we want to break them, when we still want to break them, well, there'll be great suffering for us, and the joy won't come. It won't be a pleasant experience, but we should take this as a warning to ourselves, or as a note to ourselves that this is what we have to work on, and we should strive to work on it and not be content to live our lives in misery. Now the Buddha himself said, and I can't remember exactly where, but there's somewhere that I read where the Buddha said that even if you keep the precepts in misery, it's not a bad thing, because it's challenging you. And this is, as I said with the mosquitoes, it's forcing you to look at the suffering that you're causing to yourself. It's forcing you to see something that you didn't see before. Because normally as soon as the stress and suffering comes up, we find a way to alleviate it. And even if that's immoral, even if it's something that leads us down the road towards addiction and to aversion and clinging, and ultimately suffering, more suffering. So the practice of morality is something that we should see as very much a part of the Buddhist teaching, and something that brings us, has the potential to bring us great joy if we can come to keep them natural. The third type of practice that potentially could lead us to joy is the practice of the practice of meditation. This is the rest of the Buddha's teaching. So we have dana, we have sila, but I would say, well, there are other kinds of good deeds that you can do that bring you joy, but we'll put them all in dana, in the practice of charity, because, you know, for example, the Buddha would talk about how when you give a gift and then you dedicate the merit to others, this is something that we often do in traditional Buddhist societies, even in the Buddhist teaching it's mentioned. This is a good deed, and it's one that leads you to happiness. So when a person died, like at the funeral, they would do many good deeds, especially for the person who died, and dedicate them to the person who passed away. And one thing that we don't maybe notice, because we think we're doing it for the person who died, but this is actually a wonderful way to overcome the grief of loss. And it's something that I always say, if you want to cherish the person's memory or respect them, find a way to honor them, and do it by continuing the good deeds that they themselves practice. And try your best to do good deeds in their honor. But the great side effect, or one of the great benefits of doing that, is that it brings you joy, and it brings peace to your mind if you're grieving. That's an example, but in general, when we dedicate merit of our deeds to others, this is a thing that brings us joy and peace. It's an example, and there's other. When someone else does a good deed and you have joy in that, you appreciate that. You anumodana. When we hear someone does a good deed and we don't feel jealous and we don't feel upset. Sometimes when we're with other meditators and we hear that someone else had a chance to go on a retreat, we feel jealous and we maybe feel self-conscious, oh, I'm not good enough that I don't, or I'm falling behind or something that I didn't go on the retreat. Instead of feeling somehow joy and appreciation, when we're able to overcome that, this is a great source of joy, and many like that. But let's get to the core, especially since we have limited time. The core of the Buddha's teaching is, of course, the meditation practice. So the joy that comes from the practice of meditation, I would say, it's possible to say that it takes two forms. The most obvious source of joy in meditation practice is in the jhanas, in the samatha jhanas. And you know, depending on how you break them up and which texts you follow, we call them the samatha jhanas, or people just call them the jhanas, the Buddhist jhanas or so on. Because in the jhanas there's true joy that comes up, a very palpable joy that can arise. And it's the goal of the jhanas, in a sense. The Buddha said that one kind of meditation is simply for the purpose of joy, of happiness in the here and now. And this is what he said of the jhanas, when the attainment of them is for the purpose of happiness in the here and now. So he said, this isn't the way to purify your mind, it's simply happiness in the here and now. But I think there are some people who disregard the jhanas and who warn against. I know there was a teacher recently who wrote a book, and I read this book that he wrote, and he said that there are teachers who warn you not to practice the jhanas because you could get attached to them and so on. And I think such an idea is important to understand that's not, it isn't according to the Buddhist teaching to reject the jhanas, to reject happiness, to reject the joy that you can get from experiencing the jhanas. Now, if you're not sure, if you haven't heard this term jhana, it simply means a state of trance or absorption, where your mind becomes one pointed and you're no longer thinking about other things. Your mind is absorbed in a single object, and it can occur for minutes or hours or even days, as I understand. But it's something that brings great joy to the mind. Now, the reason why I think that it's very much encouraged by the Buddha, even though this kind of practice can't directly lead you to, or can't in and of itself, it's not enough to lead to true freedom and to true enlightenment, is that in order to get to the jhana states, to these absorptions, you have to do away with the five hindrances. Your mind has to be free from sensual desire, it has to be free from anger, it has to be free from drowsiness, it has to be free from distraction and worry, and it has to be free from doubt and confusion. And these five things, I mentioned them to those of you who came to the course, that these are the hindrance not only for us to finding joy, but also for us to see clearly. So by entering into the jhanas, you set yourself up very, very nicely to continue on to see clearly, because your mind is free already from the five hindrances. For if we don't practice the jhanas, according to another method of practice, where you don't practice the jhanas first, it's very difficult because you have all the hindrances inside of you. When we first sit down, if you haven't entered into the jhanas, you can see that there can be great suffering arise. And as I said, the suffering doesn't come from sitting here. It doesn't come from having to sit still, or even the pain in the body, the stiffness in the joints and so on. The reason why you're uncomfortable in the practice is because of the nivarana, the five hindrances. Because you still want other things, you're sitting here and you're thinking about the things that bring you pleasure in your life, and when can you go and obtain them. You're thinking about the uncomfortableness of the situation, or maybe you're angry or frustrated about this or that. Maybe you're bored or maybe sad or depressed or so on. And as a result, it's not comfortable. Maybe you feel drowsy and you're not able to continue the meditation practice, and so you're finding it difficult. Maybe you're worried about this or that, worried about bad things you've done in the past, maybe you have doubt or confusion and so on. All of these are a source for our practice to get stuck and to be uncomfortable. So there are two aspects to the jhana. The first is that it brings great joy, and this is, of course, the object of the talk here. But the second is that it's a practice. It's something that purifies our mind. So in this way we can see that the Buddha's teaching is a practice of the Dhamma. There is great joy in it, and the practice that brings joy is a practice. The things that bring us joy are in and of themselves a practice. I think this is crucial in differentiating between what I said in the beginning, the kind of joy that is not the practice, and the kind of joy that is the practice. It should be joy that in and of itself is a practice. Once it becomes just the enjoyment, then you've gotten stuck, then you've become complacent. The Buddha said even when you reach a certain stage of enlightenment, and I think he was referring to the anagami stage, he said even then to rest complacent is not according to his teaching. Even then he pushes you on to try to continue to train yourself. The appropriate thing is to always train ourselves. It's a sign of good people. It's a sign of a great person. The Buddha gave a talk on great beings, and he said, it's a sign of a great being when they don't, when they're discontent. Asantuti bahulo. A person who is going to be a great being, or who's on their way to become a great being, is someone who is discontent, who is never content with the good things that they've obtained, who continuously, constantly tries to improve themselves. So even the joy that comes from the meditations or meditations even outside of the Buddha's teaching, meditation that we find in Hinduism or Christianity or even New Age meditation, that simply bring peace and don't have as their goal the insight and wisdom into reality, there's great benefit in them, because they help to set you up to be able to see things clearly, because your mind is free from, as I said, from the hindrances, which are another level of defilement. So that's another level of joy in the practice. The final level of joy is the other type of meditation. And I was hesitant, and I'm hesitant to use the word joy, because at this point it doesn't quite fit, and it becomes difficult to explain, to talk about. But one way we can sort of ease into it is to understand that even the jhanas, even the practice of tranquility meditation, eventually you give up joy. Eventually you give up pleasure, a pleasant feeling. You give up happiness. Sukha, you give up sukha in a sense. And what do you give it up for? You give it up for equanimity. You give it up for this clarity of mind, mindful and equanimous. And dwell in the later jhanas, because you see that it's even more peaceful. It's even more sublime, it's even more refined and more exalted to be at peace. When you come to practice what we call vipassana meditation, when you come to practice, or when you start to look at things clearly, it gets a little bit more difficult, because at this point you have to look at suffering. You have to see suffering. The way to realize Nibbana is the seeing of the Four Noble Truths. The first thing the Buddha taught when he became enlightened was that the practice is to see suffering. Parinyayanti. The truth of suffering is to be understood completely. And so we see throughout the Buddha's teaching, he would constantly come back to the Four Noble Truths, he would constantly come back to suffering. And this is why we always have the problem in Buddhism. People think that we encourage suffering. But as I said in the beginning, I made reference to a doctor. And when we think of the Buddha, we think of him as some kind of a physician, a doctor. Because the problem is not the joy. We don't really have to focus on bringing about happiness and joy. Why we don't is because we know that's the default. We know that that's what's to come if we can give up, if we can be free from suffering. Now the profound thing about the Buddha's teaching is not that he said you'll find joy in the practice, but he said that you'll be free from suffering. And I think that's just so profound that we miss it. Because it seems impossible to us. How could you possibly be totally free from suffering? We think that probably the best we can do is to grab as much joy as we can and try to live with the suffering that we have. In fact, sometimes we think that's a better alternative. We think to be free from suffering would be boring. Well, we don't, but there are people who you'll often meet this, that have this sort of idea that it's better to live with the ups and downs because that's the spice of life and so on. But no, the Buddha made an incredibly bold statement in saying that he had found the path that leads to the cessation of suffering, where you have no more suffering. But again, the point is to root out the cause, to find the cause of suffering. When we find and understand the cause of suffering, when we give up the cause of suffering, when we give up our clinging to things, and when we're able to see the negative and the positive things as simply what they are, as simply having arisen, when we don't judge and compartmentalize reality, when we come to see that the things that we cling to are not worth clinging to, that they are impermanent, that they are unsatisfying, and that they're uncontrollable, that they don't belong to us. When we can see this, we will come to rise above and give up all kinds of, all sorts of suffering, every kind of suffering. The practice of insight meditation is not something that's necessarily pleasant. It's something that forces us to look deeply at the problems that we have, the things that we'd rather not look at. Everyone wants to practice a meditation that makes you happy, that brings you pleasure. But we often don't want to look at the things that are causing us suffering. We'd rather push them aside and forget about them. When we sit in meditation and we have pain, we want to change our position, or maybe sit in a more comfortable position. We want to avoid it. But we do this with everything in our lives, with all aspects of our life. When something as unpleasant comes, we immediately want to change it. We want to find a way out. We want to run away. We want to escape. The Buddha taught us to be able to open ourselves up to all experience, whether it be something that we like or something that we don't like, to be able to see it simply for what it is. And so the practice of our meditation may, as I said, challenges us and forces us to look at things that are uncomfortable. So as a result, this joy or this happiness that we're looking for, the highest happiness, which is Nibbana or Nirvana, is the hardest to obtain and the hardest to enjoy. It's very easy to, or it's much easier to enjoy a tranquility meditation, a meditation that brings you peace and calm. It's much more difficult to find the peace that comes from looking at the problems that exist in your mind, challenging yourself to give up and to let go. But it is the highest and the most exalted, because all of the other types of happiness have the disadvantage that they require some kind of effort to maintain, to perform. Any good, positive or negative act that we perform has a force to it. When we give dana, when we keep sila, it has a power to it, so it brings us happiness, it brings us joy. But the nature of force, the nature of effort, is that it's impermanent, that it has a limit, it's finite. So the more effort you put in, the more you gain from it. What's special about the practice of insight, or the practice to see things as they are, the practice of wisdom, is that wisdom isn't an effort. Wisdom is a change of direction. It's a changing of the reality of our minds, of our being. And it's that change that brings the true happiness, that brings about the realization of nirvana. And so as a result, you can say it's permanent. It doesn't go back. It doesn't run out. And so this is, we can consider it to be the highest joy. Even though there's a quote that I'll just leave you with. A monk once asked Sariputta, one of the Buddha's chief disciples, he said, well, if there's no vedana, no sensations, no feelings in nirvana, how can you consider it to be happiness? And Sariputta said, it's exactly because there are no feelings, no sensations in nirvana that it's happiness. And so I'll leave you with that, and I hope this has been somehow beneficial, at least to allow us to see that, first of all, the Buddha's teaching is a gradual path, and second of all, where that path is leading us and what sorts of things we should be aiming for, what sorts of things we should be trying to give up, and the direction we should be trying to head. I'd like to thank you all for having the patience to listen and to improve all of ourselves by trying to listen to the Buddha's teaching. And if there are any questions or questions about the meditation practice for those of you who came to the meditation course, I'm happy to take them now. Otherwise, we can just sit quietly in meditation.